Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. I gotta say, today's show is a little all over the place, but hey, tis the season. We'll dance and sing our way through the holidays with Langston Hughes' Black Nativity, Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Ballet, and Swingle Bells, a very jazzy Christmas concert. But we'll also explore the sordid lives of playwright Del Shores, hear Bah Humbug straight from the horse's mouth, and join Peter Karoff at the keyboard for a sonic survey of music by Beethoven. From Sugar Plum Fairies to Sordid Lives, Gospel to God Bless Us All, and Beethoven to the Blues, it's all coming up next on Triad Arts Weekend. As a young child, did you ever dream of becoming an all-pro football player? Or how about a premier ballerina? Only a teeny fraction of us actually achieve those sorts of fantasy career goals, and even fewer maintain their standing at the very top over many years. Today we'll get a peek into the mindset of just such a superstar. Susan Jaffe was the principal dancer with American Ballet Theatre for 20 years, and 10 years after retirement from ABT, she's still just as intense as ever. Susan's bringing her wealth of experience to the Triad as the new dean of the School of Dance at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. It's her first year heading the school's acclaimed Nutcracker production, and she's enlisted some exciting guest artists to make it extra special in 2012. Principal dancer with American Ballet Theatre Veronica Part and New York City Ballet's Charles Askegard will dance the roles of the Sugar Plum Fairy and her Cavalier Prince on Thursday night, December 13th, and Friday night, the 14th, at 7:30. That's at the Stevens Center in downtown Winston-Salem. How do you navigate the expectations of the critics, the public, your audiences, year after year, for successive years like that? That just strikes me as, I put that in the realm of Roger Federer being number one in the world for 5 years in a row. It's incredible to me. How do you do it? How did you do that?
Mostly, I did not pay attention to what critics were talking about me, because oftentimes I would go to a performance and I would watch a performance, and then I would see what the reviewer said about the performance, and it looked like the two of us were at a completely different performance. So, you know, it really is subjective. And I also believe that whatever a critic has to say about what I'm doing really has nothing to do with my path. So I really used the trajectory of my life as an artist as a path, as a journey. Not that every performance is a finished product. It's just part of the journey, part of the artist's journey. And just like Federer, you know, you can see him when you're watching him play. He doesn't hear the audience, you know, and you see that laser beam focus. He's almost completely unaware that there is an audience around him. And that's how you really have to be as an artist, in a way. You have to connect to the audience, but not allow the audience to make you afraid. In fact, I used to say to myself, you know, this is my home, and I'm welcoming you into my home, into my heart and my soul. And I'm telling you this story. So in a way, when the curtain went up, it was almost, for me, it made me feel better if I felt like I was just giving and embracing the audience, as opposed to, oh, that's a scary audience out there and I have to balance on one toe in front of 4,000 people, you know. So it's really a whole mindset. You have to change it so where it's you're bringing them into your world. But also, as a dancer, perseverance is really a big attribute to success, and also to use every situation as an opportunity rather than a success or a failure.
Susan, I know one of the first pieces you ever choreographed was the Nutcracker Ballet. Has your conception for this piece evolved over the years?
Well, this year we are still doing a Nutcracker that was choreographed and overseen by Ethan Stiefel, the previous dean, as well as other choreographers. Ethan did the bulk of the choreography, but there were other choreographers that did parts of the first act and things like that. And they used the sets that were from a previous Nutcracker, which was Bobby Lindgren's Nutcracker that had been going for many, many years. And they finally brought a new production to Bobby Lindgren's Nutcracker, and then Ethan used those sets and scenery for his new Nutcracker in 2009. We are going to be doing that Nutcracker this year, and not next year, but the year after, I will be doing my own new Nutcracker with a brand new production again. So,
all right. Talk about the demands on the dancer for this, for starters.
Oh, well, the Grand Pas de Deux with the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Cavalier. I remember when I was performing it, it's one of the most difficult stamina-wise pieces, and it's very classical, so it can be very heavy on the legs. I remember as I got older as a dancer, one of the rehearsals, we finished the finale, I finished the last pirouette, and then I just collapsed to the floor. I mean, just heaving. It's really, really, really tough, even though the difference between dancers and athletes is that we are not allowed to grimace and we're not allowed to scream or do those things. It all has to look as if it's easy as pie, which, in fact, I think for us, on top of being musical and having a point of view about the piece and about the specific steps and our character, makes it, dare I say, even more difficult than being an athlete. Of course, I'm a little bit biased, but that's what I do believe. So having said that, one of the things that we like to do here at UNCSA is to bring in professional dancers so that the students can see where they need to go, number one, and also a wonderful perk for the people at Winston-Salem to be witness to some of the big stars in New York City. This year it will be Veronica Part, who is a principal dancer with American Ballet Theatre, and in fact also the first cast of the residence choreographer of American Ballet Theatre, Alexei Ratmansky's Nutcracker, and she's glorious ballerina. So she will be here on the 13th and 14th of December, and her partner is Charles Askegaard, who used to be in American Ballet Theatre. In fact, he was one of my partners. And he is this fantastic, very, very tall, stalwart presence. And he also went on to the New York City Ballet and became a principal dancer there. He's since retired from the New York City Ballet as well to become the director of a brand new cutting-edge company in New York City called Ballet Next. And he dances and choreographs and co-directs, so he will be here to partner Veronica.
From the student's perspective, what sort of growth do you expect to see or hope they come away with throughout the production of this Nutcracker?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's so great about working on a professional production or acting as if it's a professional production is we teach the students what the art form is all about, which is performance. You know, it's one thing to be in a studio working on your tendus and pliés. It's another thing to be in front of an audience, because those steps that they work so hard and try to be so exacting, and it's so difficult to make those shapes and coordinate and all of that. But those steps are only, let's say if it were equal to a novel, it's only the words on the page. The story is actually what moves people. So when the dancer gets in front of the audience and they're more challenged to be able to tell a story musically, spiritually, physically, and all of those things, they now learning the actual art form. And also how to be professional, how to go off stage and you can't suddenly start laughing and screaming in the wings, and you can't stand on the wings when other people are trying to get out of the wings, and costume changes and putting your hair up and making sure you're, for the ladies, your ribbons don't fall out of your tights down at your ankles where they wrap the ribbons around. So, I mean, there are just so many things that they're actually learning about how to be a professional. Plus, when you are performing and doing those dances, it requires much more stamina.
in broad strokes, looking at the School of Dance at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, what are some of the pillars from decades past would you hope to build on? And then some new directions that interest you in terms of dance education in general, or, you know, your area of interest?
Well, what's so wonderful about UNCSA is that there is two separate divisions of the school. One is contemporary and the other is ballet. So there's crossover, because in today's world, you can't be a contemporary dancer without having articulation in your technique. And as a ballet dancer, you cannot be only a classical dancer. You have to be able to do all the great choreographers of today, Yuri Killian, Twyla Tharp, Yorma Aello, Billy Forsythe, Paul Taylor. You have to do everything. And no director of a ballet company in the world will hire a dancer that doesn't have the ability to do contemporary work. So what's so great about UNCSA is they're already crossing over. So the contemporary dancers work on their contemporary work in the morning, and then in the afternoon, they get a ballet class. And conversely, the ballet dancers work on their ballet technique in the morning, and in the afternoon, they get contemporary class. And they're exposed to each other, so it's really, really good for them. And I think it's fantastic. The school can create a very well-rounded dancer, which is very important. But as with all things, if you're not moving forward, you're moving backwards. So my goals are to always bring in new ideas and new trainings for faculty development. So I'm going to try my best to bring in top people to come and continually give our faculty more and more development and training, as well as allowing them and finding the funds to send them out to get their own development where they want to train as well. So we all are being nourished in our own as teachers, because if you do not keep growing as a teacher, then you can't teach as well.
University of North Carolina School of the Arts Dean of the School of Dance, Susan Jaffe. The full performance schedule for UNCSA's production of The Nutcracker is Saturday, December 8th at 2 o'clock and 7:30 through December 16th at 2 and 7. That's at the Stevens Center in downtown Winston-Salem. This year, guest artists Veronica Part, principal dancer with American Ballet Theater, and Charles Askegard, principal of New York City Ballet, will dance the roles of the Sugar Plum Fairy and her Cavalier Prince at the performances on Thursday night, December 13th, and Friday night, the 14th, at 7:30. You'll find ticket information at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and coming up later on the program, our good friend Peter Karoff is back at the keyboard to help us understand the brains and beauty behind Beethoven and bum, 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 bum. Then we'll have a swinging Christmas with Martha Bassett and the Giannini Brass. But first, we're off to the theater. Parents, some of the language in this next segment may not be appropriate for young listeners.
Now who's to judge? Who's a saint and who's a sinner?
And you know, the last time I tried to count the number of theater organizations, professional, community, volunteer, and collegiate going on in the triad, I came up with close to 40. There are probably many more, and each company has its own strengths. When it comes to showcasing plays that fall into the unique, diverse, and unconventional categories, the Winston-Salem Theater Alliance has certainly found its niche. They bring a broad range of edgy theatrical experiences to local audiences that the Theater Alliance hopes will inspire and unite the people of the Triad. Tonight at 8 o'clock, it's opening night for Sordid Lives by Del Shores. By popular demand, they've added 4 additional shows this year, and it'll run through Sunday, December 16th at the Theater Alliance, 1047 Northwest Boulevard. Evening performances are at 8, and Sunday matinees at 2. Artistic director Jamie Lawson has directed well over 100 productions for community theaters across the Triad, and he recently dropped by to talk about the 1996 play that won 14 Drama League Awards, Sordid Lives.
To me, what makes Sordid Lives work so well is that these characters are real, yet they're over the top in a mild way. And we relate to these. We all know people just like this. Oh, that's so-and-so, or that reminds me of. And the themes that are in the show, that these characters act out this wild story, the premise is a couple, the man was having an affair with someone, and it was with his wife's mother. And so they're having an affair, and she trips and hits her head on the sink in a motel room and dies. That's all pre-story.
Not just to get into
That's
it.
That's just to get started. That's just
so a little Harold and Maude as an intro.
Yeah, so that just sets the ball rolling. So the family is coming together for the funeral of the mother, the matriarch. That is a catalyst for all sorts of skeletons in the closet to come out. One of the characters is Brother Boy, who's the most memorable, or one of the most memorable. There are a couple that really stand out, and he is one of them. He is a gay man who's in therapy at Big Springs Mental Institution, and his therapist is trying to, you know, bring him out of his gayness.
Get rid of the gay.
Yeah. She has him doing masturbation therapy, and it's bizarre, but hysterical. So at any rate, he thinks he's Tammy Wynette. So there's this whole Tammy Wynette theme throughout the show, but he wants to come home for his mother's funeral. Some of the family members who think he's exactly where he needs to be in the mental institution want him to stay there. So there's that going on. And then, of course, the conflict between the man who is having the affair and the wife. So it's
a potentially stressful reunion.
It is not potential. It is definitely stressful for everybody involved. And they are not your highest class of people, but they are very real. Their situations, although they seem ridiculous, things like this do happen, unfortunately. And some of us have experienced those. And the show just has a sophistication and a heart to it. Otherwise, it would be any other TV sitcom situation. But this, the fact that it has this heart and this message, when the show wraps up, you're just like, you're left with an aw feeling. So all this ridiculousness and these escapades lead up to a really cool feeling once the show's over.
My son is not a homosexual. She just shut the hell up. I don't want to hear this. You're in denial, Latrell.
I am not in denial. Would you quit saying I'm in denial? I am not in denial.
All right, I'll quit saying it. But it ain't going to change the truth. And the truth
I
is
I don't want to hear the truth, LaVonna. Did you ever think I don't want to know the truth?
Well, this is not a newbie for you all. You've done this one before.
We have done it twice before, yes.
Yeah, I just remember it being sold out. So, I mean, that says a lot. But talk about the audience reaction. What sorts of things do you get from the audience? And, you know, why has it been so successful at Theater Alliance?
The one-liners are just too much. And the characters, the characterizations. A lot of shows you'll go to and like, oh, that was funny because of the dialogue. And this has that. And then some shows you go to and it's like, I just love that character. I related to that person and they're funny. The actor just really. And these, from day one, from the first time we did it, I think it's one of the best shows I've ever cast. As far as, you know, sometimes you cast shows and you're like, maybe I should have switched these people or what. But this one, I think I just hit the nail on the head. And people just, they fit into these characters and people just, the compliments, again, it just touches people. It's a touching show, but it's entertaining too. So that's, you know, some shows like movies like Schindler's List, you know, you go because it's historic, you know, there's an element of we want to remember this and, you know, they're that sort of things. You go to entertainment for different reasons, but this one, it just covers the entertainment aspect, the human feel that you get when you leave. So it just hits you on a lot of levels. And I think that's why it's so wildly successful. I mean, we sold it out the first time at Sika, which seats around 300 people. And our space currently seats 86. So we double up. We have to do a lot more performances to get everybody in that wants to see it.
In Daddy's eyes, I saw the years of hopes and dreams gone by.
Tell me about Dale Shores.
Dale Shores, oh my gosh, that man is what he calls a recovering Southern Baptist sissy, which prompted him to write a play that we also did called Southern Baptist Sissies, and in fact, he's currently filming the film version of that play. He, like a lot of people, myself included, struggle with growing up with a religious background. I'm very thankful that I grew up as a Baptist. I got a lot of morals and ethics and, as my mom would say, good raising from growing up in a church environment, you know, the golden rule, how to treat people. But along with that came a lot of baggage that I'm, you know, flawed and subpar. And I think Dale Shores, he makes for gay people that have gone through that. He's a hero because he's able to express these things. Again, why the show is so successful. We do get a large gay audience, but a lot of straight people. But a lot of gay people are just like, this show touches me because this is how, if I could write, this is what I would write. He just really has a way of making these characters real to you. And it's like, and that just really grabs you on a visceral level because you're like, dang, this really moves me and scares me a little bit because it's so close to home.
Should point out Sorted Lives, not necessarily for the kids can stay home for this one.
Yeah, it's one that I would encourage them to see when they're older. it's definitely one they should see.
Yeah.
It was the single bravest moment of my life, though. Came out on stage completely balls out naked. Had nothing. Nothing.
That was from the original cast recording of Sorted Lives, the movie. Leslie Jordan played the role of Earl Brother Boy Ingram. So Brother Boy, first off, interesting name, Brother Boy.
Brother Boy.
and an interesting character as well. Going through some tough times, any scenes stand out with? What's a favorite of yours from the director's chair where Brother Boy makes an entrance?
Well, Brother Boy, he really only has two scenes. One is about 15 minutes or 20 minutes long, and the other one is all of 2 minutes. So he really makes an impact in the scene, the only scene that he has that's lengthy, and that's with his therapist, Dr. Eve, who is trying to use some unorthodox principles and methods to reverse his homosexuality.
I masturbated and fantasized about you.
Well, my. Thank you.
Well, actually, it didn't turn out so good. As soon as I switched to you, now, I don't mean to be ugly, but I got kind of nauseous. And it... It failed. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. Did you try again?
No, I threw up. So I wasn't in the mood no more.
And that was Winston-Salem Theater Alliance actor Grace Smith performing the role of Earl Brother Boy Ingram. What I love about the Winston-Salem Theater Alliance location is you really feel like a participant in that audience, and you've done some other things to kind of open this up to the public as well.
The space does have its limitations. We don't have a lot of wing space, which is offstage space. We don't have a fly system, which is overhead, so you can drop things conveniently. But one of the really awesome things, people that come for the first time, they turn the hallway by our restrooms and look at the space the first time, and a lot of them, they gasp, they laugh. And then afterwards, they're like, you know, coming into this, I didn't know what to expect. And I turn the corner, and I'm like, this is a shoebox. But then on the way out, you're right at the actors. You feel like you are part of it.
Winston-Salem Theater Alliance Artistic Director Jamie Lawson. Sorted Lives by Del Shores opened in L.A. in 1996, and it went on to win 14 Drama League Awards. The Winston-Salem Theater Alliance opening performance will be tonight at 8 o'clock, and it'll run through Sunday, December 16th at the Theater Alliance Building, 1047 Northwest Boulevard in Winston-Salem. Let's take a short break. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Weekend. When we get back, get set for great music from Black Nativity to Beethoven and beyond. Next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Black theater is for everyone. That's what the North Carolina Black Repertory Company believes. And with a 33-year track record of exposing diverse audiences to black classics, developing new works, and sustaining black theater internationally, who are we to disagree? NCBRC's 12th annual production of Black Nativity by Langston Hughes is December 7th through the 9th at the Arts Council Theater in Winston-Salem, 610 Coliseum Drive, with evening shows at 8 and matinees at 3. It'll be directed and choreographed by NCBRC Artistic Director Mabel Robinson.
And coming up in February, the Teen Theater Ensemble performs By a Black Hand by Arthur Reese and Daryl Goodman. Mabel recently dropped by to talk about the 2012-13 season, including her work with Teen Theater. She began her career as a dancer fresh out of Juilliard, working with a veritable who's who list of great American choreographers like Martha Graham and Alvin Ailey. From there, it was on to a successful Broadway career, and her artistic accomplishments extend to television, film, and opera. Mabel now calls Winston-Salem home. Was your entree into theater through dance?
Through dance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where did you study?
I studied at BAME High School Performing Arts and Juilliard School of Music.
Oh, how about that? Yeah.
Yeah. I worked with Alvin Ailey before he was the Alvin Ailey American Theater.
Yeah.
And Martha Graham and May O'Donnell, Walter Nix.
The biggest names in modern dance.
Yeah.
In every history book in dance, mm-hmm. they mention Alvin, they mention Martha Graham, mm-hmm. and you were there. Any common traits you gleaned from their, I know, wildly different perspectives in terms of how they approach their art, but any common themes in that world that you came across?
You know, the commitment and giving the artists a chance to investigate who they are, you know. It happens, but they lock you a little bit more because they're so stylized in their treatment of choreography. But they were so thorough. There was a constant growth. And if they didn't have it as individuals, as artists themselves, they were smart enough to have creative artists around them that was an encouragement or put another level on the work, you know, and it was about the work.
It seems like that's a common thread in that a lot of these artists lived on the edge in the sense of creativity. Like mm-hmm. they would go where the art led them instead in getting out of their comfort zone.
Right, exactly. But, you know, if you live life to your fullest, you have to get out of the comfort zone to grow. You know, you can't stay in that safety zone all the time. And, hey, it gets boring. You know, who wants to do the same thing all the time? I mean, and it's a gift that you are able to be free enough to allow others' opinions to come in and, you know, and to use them or to see how they are valuable, you know.
Let every heart prepare him room and heaven and angels sing.
It is like one of our sure things, and people ask for it. It has become one of the, well, it's our nutcracker, I guess. And people say, well, you know, oh, Black Nativity, what are the dates? That's part of my celebration of the holidays.
Mary, did you know that your baby boy would save our sons and daughters?
Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new?
Of course, it's the story of the birth of Christ, and it's done in a gospel with an Afrocentric look and styles musically and gospel. It's easy for everybody to deal with, you know. It's easy listening. There are wonderful singers and exciting dancers in there. The costumes are fantastic. The lights are spectacular, you know. And each year there's something different because each year we have a new talent. You know, there might be a new singer or a new dancer. This year we are really blessed because we have a new angel and we have a new Mary and Joseph and we have a new narrator. So I am excited to see what's happening. It's always exciting when you have doing a piece that's long, when you have new energy coming in and expressing themselves the same story, but just telling it with a little more flick or a flack or whatever.
Isn't that just what we want for our holidays? I mean, we love our traditions,
right.
But we want to spice it up a little bit.
Right, and that's what it is. Do it the traditional way for Winston-Salem, but spice it up a little way how they like to hear it and see it.
Let's talk a little bit about the teen theater productions coming up, beginning with By a Black Hand, and that's an Audie Reese and Daryl Goodman production.
Yes, exactly. It's a history that's done in hip-hop style. It's using multimedia with slides, and it talks about Black inventors and musicians It was a piece that was brought to the festival, and it was one of our fringe benefit pieces. And then when we saw it, we thought that it was a good piece for our students to do, for our teens to do. It was educational for them. It was educational for their peer groups. It was interesting to everybody. And then we had the old school versus the new school, so they could see how Duke Ellington's music would influence today's person, you know what I mean? And all the different people that are there and we know about were brought forward so that it became interesting for the other people because of the way they were told. Last Class is a piece by Sam Art Williams, and it has a little rock, you know, in it. You know, it has a spiritual that's developing different styles, so it goes from old school to hip-hop. You know, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around is what it's called. It's like a feel song. And it's about at-risk children that were kicked out of the school system and had no place to go. And that's one teacher that decided that these children, they weren't given a chance. So that she took her time to do this. She and about eight other teachers decided to take these young people in and prove that all, if they were given that attention and the love that they needed and taught that they were important enough, that they too could learn. If you knew how to reach them one-on-one, they too could see who they were about and how valuable they were, and would graduate high school and go on to other things.
North Carolina Black Repertory Company Artistic Director Mabel Robinson. NCBRC's 12th annual production of Black Nativity by Langston Hughes is December 7th through the 9th at the Arts Council Theater in Winston-Salem at 610 Coliseum Drive, with evening shows at 8 and matinees at 3. On January 15th, the company will celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday with a showcase of regional talent that will be free and open to the public. And coming up in February, the Teen Theater Ensemble performs By a Black Hand by Arthur Reese and Daryl Goodman. And don't forget to mark your calendar for the National Black Theater Festival coming up in July of 2013. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We've got Beethoven, Bah Humbug, and the Blues coming up on the second half of the show.
A very smooth-sounding performance can be a really difficult performance, but the level of the musicians and their level of comfort they have with each other really makes that happen.
Back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Care Off at the Keyboard with our good friend, Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Care Off, understanding classical music.
For today's musical moment, we'll be spending a little bit of time with Ludwig van Beethoven, one of the great monumental figures in all of music history. We value Beethoven's music in so many ways, for its drama, and for occasionally its expressive and serene beauty. And for its exploration of the human soul. Beethoven really took music to a new place. But one of the things we note in Beethoven's music throughout his life was a fascination with the idea of a musical motive. A motive is just a little short fragment of a melody, like in the famous Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And what Beethoven does is use that little tiny kernel, almost like a brick, to build a giant palace. He'll take a melody and these little fragments, these little motives, and build them one upon the other, almost like DNA creating a large organism. it creates a sense of integration and almost inevitability in the music. For example, here you have a motive here. So that melody is then repeated a little higher. Still higher. A little bit later in a new key. That teeny little idea of just a few notes permeates the entire piece. I'd like to show you how this motivic unity works in a piece written towards the end of Beethoven's life. This is the Sonata number 30 in E major. By this point in his life, Beethoven was deaf. It's quite incredible to think about the fact that from the time he was about 30 or so, he began to lose his hearing, and inexorably it just faded away. And many of the greatest works that we treasure of his, like the Ninth Symphony, he never actually heard out loud. Let's listen to one of these late sonatas. This is number 30. Well, we have a motive in the right hand, which repeats over and over in the piece. But even without hearing it, there's also a kind of hidden motive in the bass. Down here. And those four notes become the motive of the second movement. And the bass here is the bass we heard in the first movement. Here it is in the second movement. A little bit later in that second movement, we hear this melody. And that little fragment turns into a major key, and then we hear it in the third movement. So this concept of a motive or a tiny musical fragment that permeates the entire composition is more than simply taking an obvious melody and repeating it somewhere else. These motives are often invisible, this kind of integration of the material that Beethoven's so famous for. He really spent a lot of time on these compositions and worked them and reworked them and thought about them and put them away and thought about them again. And so the more you study them, the more almost like a living organism they seem. Again, the way a bass line in the first movement turns into the bass line in the second movement. The way a secondary melody in the second movement turns into the main melody in the third movement. And this is what we mean when we say Beethoven's music has this motivic unity. It's unified on so many levels, the obvious and the less obvious. It's an astonishing display of a musical integration in which the tiniest kernel of an idea generates the overall structure of the piece.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Kerhoff. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and that's a little old segment we like to call Kerhoff at the Keyboard, Understanding Classical Music. Beethoven was a sometimes cantankerous old man, and for good reason. Coming up a little later on in the program, we'll touch base with yet another ill-humored chap. Mr. Ebenezer Scrooge makes his way to the studio. I'll talk with North Carolina Shakespeare Festival's Michael Huey, who will embody the Charles Dickens character for us and explain what made Scrooge, Scrooge. In the meantime, though, we've got nothing but good holiday cheer here on Triad Arts Weekend. For lots of folks, the end of Thanksgiving means the beginning of holiday Christmas music. The Carolina Winter Music Festival presents Swingle Bells in the Triad with the mighty Giannini Brass, singer Martha Bassett, and the Christmas Jazz All-Stars with bassist Matt Kendrick and friends. Swingle Bells, a very jazzy Christmas concert, will be Tuesday, December 4th at 3 o'clock and 7:30 in the James A. Gray Auditorium in the Old Salem Visitor Center in Winston-Salem.
You'll find links to ticket information at wfdd.org/triadarts. And in the meantime, get ready to swing with Giannini Brass and Winston-Salem French horn player Joe Mount.
We have crowds that come, we fill the place up, and everyone's ready to get into the holiday spirit. And we try to add to their positive feelings about the holiday season, and it's everyone comes away with a smile on their face.
There's nothing like brass to bring that out, though. I mean, a brass ensemble, you go right to the goosebumps.
Yeah, you know, all those great CDs like Canadian Brass, Empire Brass, the Giannini Brass. You know, we've all got
there you go.
CDs that actually you play anything on with a brass quintet and it can sound like Christmas. But, of course, you know, the Salvation Army, you know, that's another tradition, the brass players out on the streets. Around here it's not so bad, but up north they're freezing their lips off, you know.
This is one of those ensembles in the area that still catches folks by surprise, just the quality. Kicking it off with a couple pretty hot trumpet players. I mean, Ken and Anita are just stratospheric.
Yeah, they're both first class. We've got both the Winston-Salem and Greensboro Symphonies, and Anita is just an amazing trumpet player. Ken is a great classical and jazz player, so he plays a number of jazz solos on this concert as well.
That's right. I've heard him in jam sessions. He says he's like a little Chet Baker.
He is. He really is. He looks sort of like Chet Baker, too, I guess.
With the teeth, though. He's got the tough life of Chet Baker.
That's right.
Then we got
he's like the wholesome Chet Baker, I guess.
That's right. He's a double dad now.
Yeah,
he's,
right.
And then, of course, you're playing French horn. The great Joe Mount, French hornist, Chris Ferguson. And trombone and Matt Ransom playing tuba, and it's a great sounding group. You play together in the orchestra and then you get a chance to do something completely different. It must be fun.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, it's a little bit more intimate, a lot more back and forth between us. We've been playing together so long that everything just clicks really easily. So we have a good time with it.
How about that difference, Joe, from playing in an ensemble of 80 and going from that into a chamber music scenario where you guys, you're in a brass quintet? What's it like just psychologically, musically, whatever?
You know, it's a chamber music feeling. You know, there's a lot more communication. We're running the show. We get rid of the conductor, you know. We're responsible for making it happen.
So no excuses when things don't go right.
That's right.
You can't blame it on the conductor.
And with this group, it's really nice because everyone can play their instruments. We all have sort of a similar thoughts on articulation, and the intonation is really good. And
for those who aren't musicians, when you say articulation and intonation, what are you talking about?
Yeah, when you hear a really great group, whether it's a string quartet or a brass quintet or a soloist and a pianist, all the entrances will happen together. So five people have to take a breath and start a note together, stop a note together, or if you have a lot of fast notes, they have to be played together. So it just sounds smooth. So a very smooth-sounding performance can be a really difficult performance, but the level of the musicians and their level of comfort they have with each other really makes that happen.
And you mentioned that you all have been playing together for a while, the brass section. And this rhythm section, which is just outstanding, they've been playing together for 20, 30 years. Matt Kendrick on bass and Freddie Pavetta keyboards and John Wilson drums. They're a real triple threat.
Their enthusiasm is just contagious, you know. I mean, you've got John Wilson, who's so energetic, and Fred and Matt, who are great artists. And so all of a sudden, you've got eight people. You've got a quintet and a rhythm section. It's almost like a mini big band sound.
And then you throw into that mix the great Martha Bassett and a voice that's, she just got a certain, there's a special quality to that voice. I can't put my finger on it, but it just draws you in.
Yeah, Martha's got a wonderful voice. She can both sing classical jazz. She sings some Americana. Very flexible, versatile person. And then her intonation is so great, you know, which is one of those things you want in a singer. And it's a beautiful quality, and she's so fun to watch perform because she looks like she's having such a great time. I really think she is having a great time. I think audiences really pick up on that.
And since we know a place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. Doesn't show signs of stopping.
She strikes me sometimes as the anti-diva. I mean, she can do the diva thing, and she has a great stage presence, but it's very accessible.
She is really the anti-diva. There is no diva, unless it's buried very deep, there is no diva qualities in Martha. She's just a wonderful person to work with, and she doesn't want to hog the limelight. She's just up there to sing.
Let It Snow. It's just like it was written for a brass ensemble.
That's right. That's one of the great upbeat tunes we do. And that's one with all nine musicians playing, five brass players, a rhythm trio, and Martha singing it. And two-thirds of these arrangements we're playing, like Let It Snow, are original arrangements written just for this grouping of people. And this concert, we've hired a well-known arranger named Roger Pemberton, who used to arrange for TV and for Woody Herman and a variety of vocalists. And he's retired in South Carolina, and he's done all these arrangements for us.
He arranged for the Thundering Herd?
He did. He was a member of Woody's band, and he did arrangements for him and some of the vocalists. He's like a Mozart. You know, he's one of these guys that can sit down with a pencil and a paper and doesn't need a piano. He can do this on an airplane. He can put out a full big band arrangement just, you know, by himself.
And with Martha's jazz singing background now, when she sings Let It Snow, she's really swinging.
Oh, she is really swinging. And that's one of about seven or eight tunes that Martha sings on. And she does a great Santa Baby. She's going to do I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, the Christmas Waltz, a lot of just real standard things that folks like. And then we do some pieces with just the brass. We do You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch, and we do an interesting version of Jingle Bells, and we do a Zydeco version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
Sounds great.
It is, yeah.
And I love the You're a Mean One, Mr. Grinch.
Well, there we go.
That's a great tune.
Sounds like we found our vocalist for that.
I'm on board for that one.
Bring the kids, bring the whole family, bring your grandparents, bring your grandkids. We're going to have hot cider at the intermission. We probably have a little sing-along at some point during the concert as well. It's very affordable. We haven't raised our ticket prices, and it's probably one of the best deals in town.
She didn't see me creep down the stairs to have a pee. She thought that I was tucked up in my bedroom fast asleep. When I saw Mommy tickle Santa Claus underneath his beard so snowy white, oh, what a laugh it would have been if Daddy had only seen Mommy kissing Santa.
Winston-Salem Symphony French horn player Joe Mount. He's one-fifth of the great Giannini Brass. And on Tuesday, December 4th at 3 o'clock and 7:30, you can hear Joe and his quintet perform Swingle Bells, a very jazzy Christmas concert. They'll be joined by singer extraordinaire Martha Bassett and the Christmas Jazz All-Stars with bassist Matt Kendrick and friends in a performance of all your Christmas favorites and then some. The concert's brought to you by the Carolina Winter Music Festival, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. Tickets are $18, $5 for students.
If Daddy had only seen Mommy kissing Santa Claus last night.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Go grab your goose and another lump of coal for the stove. It's time to hunker down with a timeless tale. The North Carolina Shakespeare Festival is gearing up for its 2012 presentation of the Charles Dickens classic, A Christmas Carol. The performance includes professional, local, and child actors. This year's production will also touch thousands of students with nearly a dozen school fest matinees planned for school groups across the triad. Performances will be December 5th through the 23rd, with evening shows at 7:30 and weekend matinees at 2 o'clock at the High Point Theater. 1977 marked the festival's premiere season, and since then, the Charles Dickens classic story has become a real holiday tradition for families, schools, and groups throughout the triad, with over 600 performances. You'll find a link to their complete calendar summary on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This year, returning to the North Carolina Shakespeare Festival is the extremely talented and versatile actor, writer, and teacher, Michael Huey. Nearly two decades ago, he performed the role of young Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, and this month, he becomes that complicated, cantankerous old character, Ebenezer Scrooge himself. Michael stopped by WFDD last week, and we talked about this wonderful holiday tradition, Charles Dickens, and what he's learned about old Scrooge from the inside out. These holiday traditions, they're so important to us because it's kind of reflective of our childhood. It's one thing we've done year after year since we were little. And so in a sense, it has to be traditional in a certain part of that, but it also has to be fresh. And people are always looking for ways of keeping it fresh and new. And I imagine approaching a Christmas Carol, that's kind of a fine line to walk, and you're Scrooge. So
very much so. Yeah, we're not reinventing the wheel. But yeah, I mean, I think Christmas Carol, though, is one of those traditions. It's like the cast and I will talk about the various versions, the film versions and, you know, Scrooge McDuck even, you know. It's so iconic. I mean, it's like, you know, it's in your blood. I mean, you know the lines. And I think one of the hardest things about acting it is if I were to say to anyone now, okay, do Scrooge, they'd start doing Scrooge.
Yeah.
Easy to do a caricature and... Of course, as an actor, that's the last thing you want to do.
Art imitating life, in a sense, for the guy. I mean,
Yeah, very much so, yeah. I'm actually reading this book now called The Man Who Invented Christmas by Les Standiford. And it's about Dickens writing Christmas Carol and what motivated him. He had to self-publish it. His publisher was like, nah, we don't want to do that.
I had no idea.
He was in a decline. This was after a lot of his really successful stuff, like Nicholas Nickleby and Oliver Twist and Old Curiosity Shop, which was huge. And he wanted to do something before Christmas. And his publisher said, I don't think so. So he basically used them as a printer, and he paid for it and got it out, chose his illustrator, you know, designed the book and everything. And this book actually calls it the most well-known story in the English language. I think it's, you know, you could debate that, but I think that there's some merit to that.
What are some aspects of Scrooge that you've discovered either personally working through the character or through your research that may have surprised you?
Well, Scrooge is not just a mean guy without reason. I think the big deal about him that I sort of discovered, I guess, is that he's just keeping the entire world at arm's length might be too short. He is really just keeping everyone away from him. Personally, I think that he hates Christmas, especially. He says he thinks Christmas is ridiculous. You know, that what's the point in celebrating at the end of the year, you know, especially for poor people. He doesn't get that at all. But I think he hates Christmas for other reasons. I think he's had a lot of bad Christmases. You know, he has a very severe case of holiday depression, and he takes that out on everyone at the beginning of the show and throughout the year. I mean, he's never pleasant at all.
It makes me think that, I mean, if I was to see this today, now being in my mid-40s, whether I would approach it from the standpoint of, we know this guy's heart was broken at a pivotal point in his life.
I mean, his sister, Fan, who's Dickens' sister, was named Fanny, by the way, died early in her life. And she is the only person, other than his one-time fiancé, being nice to Scrooge, really, and his employer. I mean, he's had all these great examples of what you should be in life, and he just chose to disregard them and go the complete opposite direction.
Yeah.
But it is such a great story about second chances. And as an actor, you always kind of go, well, how can I relate to this character? I mean, even if you're playing, you know, the worst possible person, how can you relate to them? And so to say, you know, gosh, think about times you wanted a second chance, and here this guy gets the ultimate chance, second chance. It's, for an actor, it's the ultimate character arc. You know, you go from being, you know, just this, you know, the first time I come on, literally the entire cast backs away from me. And then, you know, I told someone the other day, I spend the first half of the play insulting everyone and the last third of the play apologizing and making up.
Scrooge, will you set up a scene for us? We'd love to hear. Gosh, I can't wait.
I'm going to do some mean Scrooge.
Good.
Yeah, this is a scene where his nephew Fred, who is very positive, comes to see Scrooge on Christmas Eve and says Merry Christmas. And this is Scrooge's response.
Hey, can I chime in with a cameo?
Please.
Can I say Merry Christmas, Mr. Scrooge?
Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Merry Christmas, Uncle.
That's your line, David.
And should I do it with a Cockney accent or New York? What do you want?
No, we're not using accents, really. Just okay. Merry Christmas, Uncle. Yeah.
Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Merry Christmas. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older but not an hour richer? A time for balancing your books and finding every item in them through a round dozen of months presented dead against you? If I could work my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled in his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should. David, you were awesome.
Oh, thank you so much, Michael. Oh, that's great. You know, the music pairs so nicely with this particular production. Was it a local composer? Do you know anything about the music? No,
there's a guy named David Bishop who composed music many years ago. And I think he was from, I want to say, Minnesota.
Okay.
David's a very talented composer and worked with the Shakespeare Festival in some of the main stage productions as well.
Okay.
Composed it. And this was 20 years ago. I was young Scrooge. And he was, at that time, he had just written the music and he was conducting us.
North Carolina Shakespeare Festival actor Michael Huey. He'll play the role of Ebenezer Scrooge in the N.C. Shakes music-filled adaptation of Charles Dickens' beloved classic, A Christmas Carol. We've been sampling from the original music for the show by David Bishop. The soundtrack album for A Christmas Carol was just recorded, and it'll be available for purchase at the High Point Theater. Preview performances begin Friday, December 7th at 7:30. Opening night is Friday the 14th, and the show continues through Sunday, December 23rd, with evening performances at 7:30 and weekend matinees at 2 at the High Point Theater. Well, that's all for today's show. Senior producer for Triad Arts Weekend is Eddie Garcia, and our assistant producers are Catherine Mobley and Bethany Chafin. Let us know what you think about the arts in the Triad and how we're covering it on Triad Arts Weekend. I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. You'll find podcasts and archived episodes at wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.